Hello and welcome to the 6th Bad Idea Podcast. This is the first recorded in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, in my new apartment. And who am I, you ask? I am one of your two hosts for this podcast, Simon Abrams.
I'm Steve Carlson, the other host.
Yes, yes he is.
Yeah.
And today we are talking to you a little bit later than usual about when this month's theme would be topical, but still, just roll with it. The theme for this month is Captain America on film, and gotta be honest, we're gonna start this because like we thought to ourselves, without even knowing whether or not the new Captain America would be any good, you know, like God, there's a lot of awful Captain America films on film by now, isn't there? There's the two made-for-TV films from 1979 and 80.
1979, they're both 79.
They're both 79, okay. Yeah. The 1990 Albert Pyun film, as well as the other film that we just threw in there for shits and giggles, Three Dev Adem, which is actually not a Captain America film. It just happens to be a film where Spider-Man happens to fight a Turkish... No, the Turkish Spider-Man is evil and is being fought by Turkish Captain America and Santo... Yeah, Turkish Santo, the Mexican wrestler. Because why not, right? We're not going to be talking about the Joe Johnston film, even though we'll be bringing it up every now and then in passing. But needless to say, Steve and I both have wildly differing takes on it.
I thought it was pretty good.
I think you're full of shit.
It's kind of square, but, you know, it fits the character, I think.
I think you don't know who the character is.
I'm just going on what's in the film, not what, you know.
Yeah, I don't think the character... I just based on that film, even if I didn't know who Captain America was based on the comics, I would think that Joe Johnston didn't know who Captain America was. He's like, I don't know, he's old. He's got old values. He's got, like, he's very sincere. He's that guy. Great, thanks. Thanks for that, Joe. I'm not fucking expecting the psychological depth that, like... Everyone was like jizzing in their pants over when they saw the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight and the Batman Begins films. But like, I am expecting a certain level of like understanding of the characters. Like, well, why does he do what he does? Because he's naively in love with his country.
Well, then you're looking to the wrong entities to do that because Marvel doesn't actually seem interested in providing that in their big, you know, interlaced tentpole films.
I agree, and that's why it sucks.
I kind of liked it because it was at least someone trying to do something with the material as opposed to, say, Kenneth Branagh with Thor.
Yeah, Kenneth...
Whose only function appeared to be to show up on set and say, action.
Yeah, Kenneth Branagh on Thor, it's widely accepted that basically what happened was he was so desperate for a gig that he was like, I can totally crank out crap for you guys that, like, is tasteless, shapeless, and totally, like, unmemorable. But it'll be what you want. And that's what we got.
That is exactly what we got, and nothing more.
Unfortunately.
Anyway.
But yeah, so...
Anyway, on to other crap that is awful.
Yes, we're gonna start with the first 1979 Captain America movie.
Which is just awful.
Yes.
It's really, really bad.
Yeah.
Like, embarrassingly so.
Yeah.
I wrote here, it's basically like a lost episode of Mannix, but with a dude in a... bad Captain America outfit.
Yeah, there's a lot of helicopter shots of Red Brown, who is this guy who looks like he's on steroids. He's got, like, huge pecs and shoulders and, like, a chiseled body but, like, a tiny head. So, he looks...
But big hair to compensate for it.
So it
big,
like,
puffy surfer hair.
Yeah, yeah, very, very calm. He kind of reminds me of, like, minus the hair thing, he reminds me of, The Brain in the episodes of Pinky and the Brain where he's walking around in his giant robot suit where it's like this guy, like, really big chest and, like, a tiny mouse head. That's Red Brown, if you can imagine that. With
basically.
Surfer hair. But there's, like, a lot of helicopter shots of him driving around the country in his blue van, presumably on the lookout for crime.
Or pussy.
Or pussy, but probably crime. Probably thinks it's the same thing, I don't know. But yeah... Like, you can tell that these guys are trying to, at least on some level, capture the zeitgeist of the 70s by one guy compliments Red Brown, Steve Rogers, by saying, hey man, pretty mellow set of wheels.
Yeah, and then Red Brown gives him a charcoal drawing.
Yes, yes. I mean, this Captain America has a weird thing for drawing an artist.
Yes, and just to point all the Red Brown as the Captain America is not the, as we're told, he's not actually Captain America. He's not the first Captain America anyway. His father is the one who created this serum that's going to give him super strength.
Yes, it's called and, Flag, full yeah. latent ability game.
Yes, it's the ultimate steroid.
Yes.
And the thing is, it's essentially a Son of Cap narrative because it's, you know, he's introduced as the eminent scientist's son, the motorcycle racer and motocross expert.
Yeah, he's a motocross expert. Notice that.
Yes, motocross expert. And the point of the thing is that...
He drives good.
He drives good. That's basically his superpower.
Yeah.
He doesn't ever use his super strength, and his super shield is a ridiculous piece of floppy plastic
that has
a couple stripes
painted. It's ridiculous.
A couple stripes painted on it, and so basically his main superpower is that he can drive.
Yeah.
He can drive this motorcycle that he has really good.
He drives it good.
Yeah, just boom, he drives the fuck out of it. But it's just, oh god, it's just... They give him the serum because his father tested the serum on himself, and it has like part of his DNA in it. So they figure that the reagent would work on him because, you know, the family link and shit.
But the interesting part, or the funny and retarded part about the whole legacy aspect of the story is that, like, where does Steve Rogers' father come up with the nickname Captain America? It's kind of like how in the original Marvel comics, Daredevil got his nickname because all the kids teased, you know, this is retarded, I think, but they teased this poor blind kid. It's like, oh, you don't do anything, you're very safe. It's like, because he's fucking blind. And, like, it's like, oh, so kids teased to tease Steve Rogers' dad about being patriotic by calling him Captain America. And, like, what's the character's name? The friend of Steve Rogers' dad encourages him, like, use that as, like, your mantle. Wear it.
Be Captain America, Steve.
Yeah, yeah.
Jam Captain America down their throats. At which point, it doesn't really sound like he's talking about a superhero anymore. But that's another conversation, I guess.
I mean, you wouldn't... That's the thing. Like, we were talking about how Steve's superpower is driving good. And it's because you don't want to hear him speak. Because on the one hand, like, you just sort of want him to, like, tell us what he's all about. But, like, time and time again, he proves that he shouldn't... Like, you want him to use your words on the one hand, and he's like, it feels pretty good in here. Like, that's actual dialogue.
Yes.
And,
yes.
Or another one where he's actually trying to, like, he's thinking about embracing being Captain America and says, I just want to kick back and find out who I am. And you're like, on second
thought, I don't want to report in or check out. I swear to God, that was the moment where I damn near turned the fucking thing off.
I like.
I was like, what? This is why I mentioned something to you earlier, why I don't think that this modern conception of Cap was gonna work, because I mean, I understand what they were trying to do, like, get, you know, some, you know, take the wild, crazy, mellow vibe of the 70s and kind of bring it back to, you know, like, back to America, you know, yeah. Try to teach this hippie some nationalism, but at the same time, he's still a bleach blonde fucking surfer bum hippie.
Yeah, walking around just like waiting for the bad guys to come up to him while he's like making charcoal sketches like little kids and stuff.
He's
not the only character that has terrible dialogue. I mean, it's not like an exclusive thing. Like, I thought we took care of on the road we dumped oil on. Or then he got you in the pictures. Then he got dead.
The spy hunter scene?
Yes.
It's just, it's a really, really bad movie. It's just miscalculation from, like, frame one. Like, it gets nothing right.
Or how about when Steve Rogers' dad's friend says, he's talking about a lab mouse that's on Flag, and he says, he's running the Hublin equivalent of 57 miles per hour.
Yes.
But he's also dying. And he says it with a straight face.
Yeah,
wow.
You gotta give him credit for trying desperately to sell that shit. But I've written here, watching this movie is like watching Captain America's dim cousin. Right down to the homemade
Larry
fucking costume with, it's basically like some kid pulled out his favorite blue jammies and put like duct tape on it and painted it and said, I'm Captain America now!
I think the most coherent way that you can describe how stupid Red Brown looks in costume is to say he looks like an asshole.
He totally looks like an asshole.
That's as descriptive as you get without, like, frothing at the mouth. Like, he just fucking looks like an asshole.
He looks like an asshole. He's got, and he's, to top it off, he's got that little motorcycle helmet with the stupid fucking Ares wings on him.
Well,
and the painted A, I swear to God, stands for asshole.
It does. It's very hard to imagine a working model Captain America's costume that works, and I understand that's why people liked Joe Johnston's Captain America, the look of him, because the helmet worked and everything.
Yeah.
So that'll give it, but, like, I mean, you're talking about the helmet? Why aren't you complaining about the fact that his motorbike looks like one of those, like, you know those little kiddie rides that you put quarters in and you ride outside the supermarkets? It looks like someone dismounted that and just, like, made it rocket out of some guy's van. Like, literally, this van, like, is propelled by, like, fire extinguisher, like huge plumes of white smoke.
Every time he opens the back of the van and his bag comes out, there's this big puff of smoke bomb smoke.
It's like something out of like a bad concert effect. Like it's just like here's Captain America, kids. He's jumping out of that pervert van and he's speeding out towards you to keep you safe. I don't know.
It's just this whole film is just indicative of everything that was wrong with 70s TV movies. I mean, there were some good ones, but there were also a lot of bad ones. And this is basically like watching a palette swap $6 million man. Except one where he doesn't do anything heroic.
The action scenes in this movie are exactly like something you would see in the $6 million man.
And I'm gonna wager it was intentional, because this came out in 1979. The $6 million man was canceled in 78.
I'm sure it was the same production company, same guys. I'm sure of it. Like, I just recently watched, like, a whole box set of the $6 million man. That show is terrible. And it has the same level of, like, action choreography. Like, I hate that this is, like, one of the worst action scenes I can recall. Like, Rip Brown breaks away from his attackers. He's sort of swinging around a corner while riding on this is the scene in the abattoir. And he's like,
oh god!
He's riding a meat hook, and he knocks the guy off by throwing a flank of meat at him. Then he slides a piece of meat along the floor, and he trips up the last of
the
three guys
with the meat. Yeah,
with another piece of meat.
It's so terribly edited and shot and just incoherent. And Red Brown's running around with this stupid smug fucking smile on his face, and you just. And the background music sounds like an off-key version of Baker Street. And you just want to punch it.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you're looking at Captain America's shield in action. Like, Captain America's shield in this is literally made out of see-through plastic.
It wobbles when he throws it!
And it spends an inordinate amount of time floating in midair. It's just, like, flying out into space. And, like, it's like, is it ever going to come back? Is it ever going to, like, boomerang back and hit the bad guy?
It's not as epic as in the second film.
Yeah,
where he throws it and it actually hangs in the air for a while behind a guy and then swings back to him.
But the best part is, in the second movie, you find out that the shield is a removable windscreen for his little
motorbike. Yes!
And it's like, that's the most unuseful thing that you can imagine while you're driving. It's like, I'm gonna just look through these red and white striped object while I'm driving.
And he's fortunate in that all the bad guys, who all have guns, all aim straight for the shield. You know, so they can hit. He's on the bike. The shield does not protect all of him. It protects basically up to his gut. But the bad guys are all considerate enough to fire at the shield.
Do we even remember what the plot of this first movie is?
It's about a guy who has a neutron bomb.
Yes, and the Project Zeus.
Yeah, and Cap has to stop him.
Yes, okay.
But first he has to come to grips with being Captain America.
Yeah.
So, and that means it falls into a genre that I fucking hate.
What?
The hero not being a hero genre.
Yeah, it's like the anti-origin story.
Yeah.
It's like, seriously, if you can't think of an origin story, that's what you resort to. You resort to the, the Spider-Man No More type archetype, where it's like, I'm
even,
just gonna throw
even
it
to bring
away.
It back, the recent Thor movie, where Thor spends much of the movie not being Thor, because he's been stripped of his powers.
Yeah.
It's like an origin story by way of not being an origin.
Yeah, it's kind
of
irritating.
I understand the point of it. It's supposed to be, you know, you man up, accept your responsibilities.
Yeah.
But a good movie can do that in one act.
Yeah. It's pure formula storytelling. We were talking about this earlier, but, like, there's a difference in terms of what era of filmmakers could do. Like, I know most people are going to laugh at me for thinking this, but I think the first Punisher movie is the best of the three that came out, because just on a conceptual level, it's much more ballsy.
Oh,
well, thank you, Kent, if you're listening. The fact is, it gets all that origin story crap out of the way in the first scene where there's like a newscaster describing, it's like, well, here's who Frank Castle is. Frank Castle is a guy who watched his family murdered in Central Park. Then he turned into a guy that murdered the mafia. And there we go. And it's like, fine. That's awesome.
Now we can get down to the Punisher movie.
Exactly.
And that's what I was telling you earlier. That's also why I appreciated Punisher Warzone. Because right. It assumes you know the origin already, because there was already an earlier Punisher movie.
It's the same thing with the Letarian
cult. 2 minutes into the film, it just lets Frank Castle go wild and just murder shit.
Yeah, I
get that. And the Norton Incredible Hulk as well.
Yeah, like, that's a good one.
It's like, you know he's the Incredible Hulk. You know how
he's on the
there.
Run.
Yeah.
He's in Rio.
I think it was Rio.
Rio?
No. It had to be one of the Central American countries because he was speaking Spanish.
Where is whatchamacallit, Elite Squad filmed?
That was Brazil.
Brazil. That's where it is.
Was it?
I'm pretty sure it's Brazil.
Because he was speaking Spanish in the opening scenes. They speak Portuguese in Brazil. I'm just saying.
If you can correct us, I'm sorry if we've offended you. I just legitimately thought it was Brazil.
It's all right.
In any case.
But, yeah, so, anyway, that's why Red Brown's an asshole.
Yes. So, moving on to Captain America 2, which is actually...
Which is the continuing adventures of Red Brown the asshole.
Yeah.
But, at least because it does have the origin story out of the way, it gets to actually provide some low-key, silly fun for about 20 minutes. I think the opening of the film is pricelessly silly and thus kind of entertaining.
The first Snatcher?
Yeah!
And the first Snatcher is driving around on a dune buggy, mind you. And he's driving down the beach, and Red Brown is chasing him on foot. And then after, like, he pulls the driver out of the vehicle, we get this totally gratuitous shot of the dune buggy veering safely into the water.
And of course, Captain America's here hanging out on what has to be this little California beach community.
Yeah.
Saving the old ladies from purse snatchers, because what else does Captain America have to do?
He's keeping the neighborhood safe.
Yeah. Your friendly neighborhood Captain America.
Which is then why it's natural that, like, the villain that he fights isn't a local villain. He's like Christopher Lee.
Miguel,
the cousin, the retarded cousin, apparently, of Carlos the Jackal. which I'm positive that's what they're responding to. Miguel, like, who's a good... there's this Carlos guy. We're gonna call him fucking Miguel.
So, Miguel. But it doesn't matter because it's Christopher Lee, and Christopher Lee is awesome.
He is.
His mere presence improves the film.
It's just like saying that... This brings me back to the Mystery Science Theater 3000 argument about Gene Hackman and Maroon. It's like, yeah, it's Gene Hackman. He's usually great.
It's still Gene Hackman.
He's just there, though.
I don't know. I haven't seen the movie, so...
It's awful. Okay. Anyway.
But
yeah, Christopher Lee's character, Miguel, is, like, obsessed with, like, he's got this formula that will either age people rapidly or make them stay young. And, yeah. There's this great scene where Red Brown is chasing Christopher Lee. The latter of whom is sort of driving around very cautiously, like looking around over his shoulder, not paying attention to what's in the road in front of him. And he's squinting his eyes, principally squinting his eyes, so he'll better see Red Brown coming. And it's such a painful scene. It's like RoboCop 3 painful. Like RoboCop riding around, like watching like Red Brown hang glide with his motorcycle.
The fucking hang gliding scene.
It's as bad as the scene where you watch RoboCop and RoboCop 3 fly around with his jetpack.
See, I think
RoboCop 3.
RoboCop 3. I do think that Cap 2 has a certain advantage in that I think everyone realized that they were making a bunch of bullshit. And the first, like, 15 minutes of the film and the last 15 minutes of the film are just pure, insane bullshit. Like, you know, there's that scene, it's after the first Snatcher scene, it's before he goes into the town, though, where he's being chased by some random goons or something, and he swings his shield into this one dude's face, and this dude does a little dance, he swings his shield out, and the dude does this little weird little shuffle, and then jumps right into Cap's shield, like literally just throws himself headfirst into the shield. It's so stupid and great and kind of weirdly entertaining. And then the last 10-15 minutes of the film are just this stupid action scene where Red Brown's crashing the prison that Miguel's holed up in. and he's doing shit like literally throwing his bike up onto a prison wall so he can jump up and ride it, but the effects are so bad that they lift the bike up on a string, and then they go to put it down the wall, and it pauses, because they can't figure out exactly how far to drop the bike, so it hovers for just a bit, and then it hits.
But then again, I mean,
there's that wonderful little music sting that happens every time he does something even slightly superhuman. That wah wah wah.
Yeah. The wah. Someone was hitting the wah wah pedal during that score pretty bad. It's like a bad 70s porn music.
Yeah.
Wah wah wah. And it's like it's. I mean, you're right. The action choreography in this one is just as ludicrous, if not more so, than the first. Like.
But you know, it's like they hold on. Okay.
Normally in action scenes, you'll see guys thrown into like a pile of bricks or like some crates or like barrels to show you how like strong the hero is. This guy, Rep Brown, throws people into wicker furniture. He throws them into patio sets.
Yes, he does.
Matching stuff like, and like, Rep Brown's Captain America is such a pussy that bullies try to convince Steve, who's like, he's painting a portrait of a marmalade cat named Heathcliff.
Yes, and I would just like to point out that this is the only instance in the history of everything in which Captain America has painted a kitty.
Yeah. But yeah, these guys try to convince Steve to leave town by painting glasses on the cat. He says, there, now you can see. I can easily get you the same prescription.
Don't fuck with a man's cat painting, I'm just saying.
Yeah. And then, you know what Steve's comeback is? It's all right. I can see perfectly clear now.
And he gets this smug little look on his face like, ooh, burn!
Yeah, really. Oh my gosh. But did you notice, let's backtrack a moment. Just a fun fact.
Okay.
Did you notice that the two main good guys in the first Captain America movie, their first name are Steve and Simon?
Oh!
Mainly mentioned that just because Joe Simon was actually one of the co-creators of Captain America. Just a fun fact.
Okay. But it does kind of break my heart, though, because you have all this idiocy on the bookends, like they realized that the action choreography was shit, so just go nuts with it. Then, right in the middle of the film, it just grinds to a fucking halt. From the minute Cap enters the town and sits down and paints that kid,
it's over.
It's like
that
suddenly,
cat killed the film.
Totally. Fuck that cat. It realizes, oh wait, we have a story to tell about aging serum that's being used on this small town, but no one wants to talk about it. So Cap's gonna hang around the town and ask people about it and get no's until they decide to tell him yes.
Yeah.
And then this kid's lamb dies, and then everyone sits in a field and stares into space, and then other stuff happens.
And we
forgot we were making a Captain America film. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's like. It's another thing. Like there's a lot of. I mentioned this earlier, but there's a lot of Christopher Lee driving around very cautiously. Like, how much tense driving can you stand? Because like he looks left, tense. He looks right, real tense. He makes a right hand turn, tensely.
Tense. I would just like to point out that this is indicative of how this grinds to a halt. This is an actual line of dialogue from late in the film. The entire population of Portland is... Where was it? The entire population of Portland is going to age a week while you make that coffee. They're having a...
Drama.
Absolutely. It's like someone's making coffee. And because it's Cap's trying to spur them into action to let him know where something is. But that's just it. No one wants to help him.
Yeah.
So he's just sitting around this town like a bum, like... Well, I guess I'll just wait for information to come to me.
What's your favorite out-of-context quote from this film? Because there's so many good ones.
I've never seen skywriting break up like this!
That was a good one. I like, tell me where the lavatory is, Anne. I can end that nightmare now. And she responds, I can't!
But it's mostly just more of the same once it stops being retarded.
Yeah.
It settles down and decides to become just another bad 70s TV movie. And really the most interesting part about it is it's directed by a fellow named, I think it's pronounced Ivan Nagy.
You're one up on me there, buddy.
Well, he achieved a measure of infamy in the early 90s when he was revealed as one of Heidi Fleiss's main clients.
Who?
the Hollywood Madam.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway. So
let's move on to Albert Pyun's 1990 Captain America, a film that we just watched,
which is already
forgotten most of.
Which I think it exists in order to make the 1979 Cap look less terrible.
Yeah, that movie jumps around in time and place, like, constantly. It's like 1 month later, 7 years later. Yeah. We're in Rome. We're in Northern Canada, somewhere in Alaska. And it's like...
We're in California.
This film was shot in the dark. There were no lights. It's all blue, all red. Lots of filter work.
Yeah.
This camera can't stay still. Dolly in. It's like Albert Pyun, wherever you are, if you're actually going to get uppity, because apparently Albert Pyun has a habit of actually, like, commenting on people's stuff whenever they mention his name. It's like a Pavlov effect. If you're listening to this...
You're a shitty director.
You're terrible. I think you could be a fine human being. I'm sorry to tell you this, and I'm sure you're not the first person, and we won't be the last, but man, you suck.
Yeah, you're not very good at this whole directing thing.
It's a dick thing to say. I understand, even if it's something we're never going to see, but good God, this movie is dreadful.
It's really, really awful, and it has the same fundamental issue that the Red Brown Cats have, in that, and maybe it says something larger about the character, but it forgets that it's a Captain America movie.
Which is, it's a tough thing to do, because, like, of all the Captain, of all the Marvel heroes, it's probably very tough for someone that doesn't know what the comics are about, and hasn't read the comics, and doesn't understand what makes a good superhero work. I would say of the Marvel heroes, like, I can see how people would have the hardest time with the Captain America film. Because, you know, how do you do something that, like, a guy that is basically a walking flag? It's very tough.
His nationalism is kind of tied into his identity as a superhero.
And it's very tough to make something like that, you know, anything more than, like, very stiff. Mm. So
Pyun tries to solve it by turning it into a distaff James Bond globetrotting adventure.
Yeah, which is, you know, it would be fine if it was actually, you know, James Bond circa Sean Connery rather than, like, Timothy Dalton.
Yeah. It's very, very, very poorly directed.
It's very choppy. It's very all over the place.
It's like the action scenes in it are like, you think Michael Bay's compositions are incoherent. You gotta look at Pyun's. I mean...
Because at least Pyun's cameras are stationary enough that, like, if you thought there was proper lighting, you could actually see what's going on. But there isn't proper
lighting. There isn't proper lighting. And there's never proper framing either. Like, the one bit at the end with Ronnie Cox gets the gun back from someone, I think it is. It's about six or seven shots cut together in quick succession, and it's all framing people's foreheads. Because he doesn't even know where to put the camera.
Yeah.
So he figures the quick cutting will provide the illusion of movement and action.
He's like the Catherine Hardwick of superhero directors.
That's harsh.
We watched Red Riding Hood together, man. You know what I'm talking about.
I know, but I'm just saying, that's harsh. It's true, but it's harsh.
We did, yeah. It was a bonding moment.
It was.
Anyway,
and Red Riding Hood's terrible too.
It's awful.
Yeah.
Albert Pyun, are you listening to this? Red Riding Hood is just as bad as your movie.
I'm going to go on the record and say that if Albert Pyun had made Red Riding Hood, it would be a better film.
Holy shit.
Yes, I said that.
Holy shit! You just laid the gauntlet down.
I did.
Albert Pyun, are you listening?
Anyway. Albert Pyun, you're better than Catherine Hardwick at least. I'll give you
that.
I will give you that.
That's the worst backhanded compliment I've ever heard. Anyway,
But yeah, it's
an utterly forgettable movie, especially since, like, we had to, like, while we were watching it, like, provide our own, like, subtext for what makes this film interesting. Like, there's randomly a scene, like, for some reason the Red Skull in this film is Italian. Why the hell he's Italian, I don't
know. He's Italian instead of German, but the actor appears to have decided to try and compromise the accent.
Yes, he sounds like Count Chocula.
Totally.
He sounds like he's from Transylvania. He doesn't sound Italian, he doesn't sound German, he just sounds like the generic European.
Yeah.
And, like, there's a scene where they're at this guy's castle where Ronnie Cox plays the President of the United States who's been kidnapped by the Red Skull.
And he's a super liberal who's super into environmental issues.
Yes, he's super
into because Menachem Golan produced this. And remember, he also produced The Quest for Peace, the fourth Superman movie.
Yes.
Which also had a big, fat, fucking environmental message in it.
Yeah. Fuck the environment. Anyway, my point is...
Captain Planet's gonna come get you for that.
If he can find me. Anyway, so yeah. This... taking place in this ridiculous castle by the sea. And it, like, there's this scene where there's, like, randomly a piano, which is, like, it's something out of a bad Silver Age era Superman comic where, like, the ones where Lex Luthor has a piano that, like, shoots rays of Krypton at Superman depending on what keys he hits.
Yeah.
And Kryptonite, sorry. And there's, like, randomly a piano that has, like, a bomb trigger in it, and it's, like, just randomly in the middle of, like, a turret of this castle, and the Red Skull is, like, manipulating this piano to, like, let off this bomb that's supposed to level, like, most of Southern Europe, apparently.
Yeah, but he says, it, for a nuclear device, the megatonnage is not much.
It's not very much.
It's going to level the entirety of South Europe.
It's a very modest bomb. He's a very modest megalomaniac.
Well, he is a very... His aims in the film are simply to become president of the United States.
Yeah, man. I mean,
that's aiming pretty fucking low.
Yeah, I mean, did the EU exist at that point?
No.
So, what about NATO?
NATO did.
He could, yeah, try to totally take over NATO.
Or the UN.
The UN, yeah. Why the U.S.?
Because
it's Captain America.
Well, and I guess you could make a defense for it in that it ties into the whole idea of Captain America as an American symbol.
Fighting, foreigners, yeah. Fucking foreigners.
Yeah.
Who needs them?
But, you know, it's just like, and you get, you know, and of course the deficiencies in the lead actor don't help. Good old Matt Salinger, not had much of a career after this film, and watching it you can understand why. Because he's just this slab of granite with this flat face and this huge nose that's spread across it and one lazy eye.
Yeah, he's got that lazy eye. It's really distracting. Oh my god, the fact that like they made his Captain America is like the wussiest.
He's the least heroic Cap ever.
He like steals poor Ned Beatty's car by tricking him to pull over. He's like, oh, I'm feel motion sick, and Ned Beatty like comes over to see, are you all right? And he runs around Ned Beatty as if that's like an accomplishment. He runs around Ned Beatty, gets into the front seat, and leaves him stranded.
Yeah.
And you half expect, because Ned Beatty
dies in the middle of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, he strands poor Ned Beatty. It's like, dude, you just stole a guy's cutlass. This is ridiculous.
And then he does it again to some random blonde chick.
In Rome. Yeah. And like that's where like he stops being an emasculated version of Cap, when in Rome he like starts to realize, hey, I can beat people up still. I got muscles. I can kick.
Yeah.
And like.
And I would just like to point out also that it does try and get the origin out of the way pretty quickly, which I liked.
Yeah.
But it sends Cap to Alaska to be frozen in the tundra for however many years, because that's part of that's part of his story. And the thing is, it does it in this film by the Red Skull strapping Cap to a rocket and literally shooting him to Alaska. But here's the thing. Cap managed to get loose of one of his bonds and grab the Red Skull.
Yeah. Where did
he
go?
The Red Skull saws off his hand.
To get off, yeah.
To get off. And it never comes up again. The Red Skull has a hand.
Yeah.
In the modern day.
Yeah, I am assuming this is just one of the many things that is addressed in like the so-called director's cut of the film.
No.
Probably not.
Do we really want to find out?
No.
But yeah, it's definitely not a very good film at all.
But yeah, think about it this way: like this movie is so anti-foreigner that like, where does Cap get his balls back from? Italy, where he's beating up the little Italian
fascist.
I was gonna say the goofs. Oops.
Oops.
Sorry. The little Italian bad guys, and it's like. You know, I don't give this movie the foresight into thinking, like, coherently enough into saying, where is Captain America going to get his mojo back? Europe.
Yeah, and there are some interesting ideas that are brought up by the script. Like, I know you mentioned the idea of Cap waking up 50 years later and going, what happened to my world?
Yeah, I like the fact that he's basically very much made impotent by the fact that he doesn't know what's going on, all this stuff that's familiar to him, and this is stuff that's undoubtedly going to come up the Avengers movie. He's basically very disoriented. He doesn't know what's going on, and he doesn't feel like he matters anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm sure part of the Avengers movie is going to be like the other Avengers going like, we need you, Cap, and like they're going to get rescued. Like, I can guarantee you, this is how cookie cutter the script for this movie is. I'm predicting it going to happen where like the pivotal moment is going to be Captain America getting his mojo back and like helping them fight, you know, how many villains are supposed to be in this upcoming movie? There's supposed to be like Thanos, some Skrulls, there's going to be like Loki, there's going to be like your mom, like everyone's gonna be in this movie. Like,
my mom's gonna be in it.
Yeah, like she's apparently evil. I don't know why. She's apparently very. I'm sure she's a nice lady.
My mom's a nice lady. She never hurt anybody.
Sorry, Steve Carlson.
Except for those three guys a couple of years back, but that was totally warranted.
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
In any case,
they asked for it.
There's like all these guys that are apparently gonna be in this Avengers movie, and it's like, hold it, can't you just like. I'm hoping Joss Whedon will pull through on this, but I guarantee you,
and remember, this is the same Joss Whedon who, even though he has a lot of awesome things that he's done, he's also the fellow who wrote, "Do you know what happens to a toad when he gets struck by lightning?" And he refuses to take credit for how terrible that line is.
Yeah.
He insists it's just how Halle Berry delivered it. No, it's just a terrible line of dialogue, dude.
Yeah, it's like all this backpedaling he's done about Alien Resurrection, the script that he did.
Hmm.
And at the same time, like, a pivotal decision was made when he, like, he did this thing where it was, what's her name? The studio demanded that Ripley come back somehow, and, like, they do clones of Ripley. And, like, he didn't like that originally, but he had to jam it into the story rather than it just being about Winona Ryder's character. And he was originally, like, all that stuff about the cloning business in the beginning and about how, like, the alien was born out of Ripley's clone. All that stuff wasn't originally there. And that's why he's like, even though Whedon is blamed so much of the failure of that film on like the way the executives and Janae handled it, just wasn't a good idea from the start.
I would just like to point out that he's doing all this blaming, yet he was the one who apparently thought it was a good idea to center a film around Winona Ryder's shitty cybernetic character.
Yeah.
That terrible, drippy, sobby cyborg.
There's a lot of significant differences, but anyway, back to Captain America. The fact is, like, what we're trying to say is that basically the Captain America and the Avengers has a long way to go before they actually do something interesting with that angle of a man out of time in a new context. Yeah. Like, conceptually, that's a key part of who Captain America is.
Yeah.
But here, it just doesn't seem like it's actually...
It's something they did because they knew it was part of the character's story, and I kind of respect them for that because it means at least in that facet they were trying harder than the makers of the 70s films.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe there's a reason that the 70s films didn't try that, because it's really friggin' difficult to pull off.
Yeah, it's true. Well, let's get to our favorite Captain America film.
Yeah!
The Turkish Captain America. Three Devadam, which translates to Three Strong Men. And that movie is batshit. Like, it starts off a lot better. Like, it starts off a lot more crazy and exciting than it, like, eventually trails off into, I think.
Well, I think it's just because of the diminishing return, the law of diminishing returns of awesomeness.
Yeah,
which is something a lot of people cited, say, with this year's Drive Angry. Which is, if you try to construct an entire movie out of awesome, it's just going to get exhausting.
Yeah, it reminds me of a review of this We Are Scientists album, where they're like, you know, this isn't an album, it's just like a bunch of singles crammed into one package. And I didn't agree with that criticism, but I think that it's actually a pretty good conceptual like idea of what can go wrong when fans or even filmmakers try to film scenes around what you're talking about, like,
well, like
why shots.
I think David Comes to Life is a big breakthrough for Fucked Up. Because to me, the two previous Fucked Up albums just felt like a series of crescendos.
I don't agree, but okay.
But anyway, I'm just saying.
Back to Three Devadam.
Yeah.
This is a movie that opens with a woman being buried up to her neck in sand and a working motorboat engine, like, being shoved through into her mouth.
And it's all done by an evil Spider-Man.
Yes, evil Spider-Man with Mount Arnold-sized eyebrows.
Oh my god, they're so huge and they're so beautiful.
They are amazing, and he's got a paunch, and his shirt is like green where it should be blue. And it's like, they even have a reference to the fact that he's wearing green, where he's like, let's get that green...
That green sadist.
Yes, he's a sadist.
Yes.
Evil Spider-Man in this film is like a pervert. He will creep around can like sneak up on women and strangle them. And he's got like a switchblade. Yeah, yeah. There's a woman that he strangles to death with like her what's it called?
It's like the little soap on a rope type thing.
Or? No. It's the when you're in the shower, like the shower head, the rope.
Oh yeah, the shower heads that come out. And
she reaches for a bar of soap and she's like, you know, minding her own business, washing herself in her own bathroom, and Spider-Man steps on the bar of soap as she reaches for it, and then he like strangles her, and you're just like wondering like, what was the point of that?
he had some aggression needed to work out, man.
Or like when he sneaks in on this like couple like having sex in their bedroom through like their veranda, and they're just like, Jesus Christ, like Spider-Man is a sex maniac.
Yeah.
He is like.
And then he skewers both of them with some pointy thing, and then it turns into a psycho homage.
Yeah. Or my favorite death scene that this guy's involved in. Because this guy is infinitely more interesting than Turkish Captain America, but this Turkish Spider-Man tortures a man by creating, like, a really long tunnel, like...
Almost like a habit trail.
Yeah. Like, if you can imagine some of the stuff that, like, you know, hamster cages have all these elaborate little tubes and tunnels. Just, like, a straight, really long tunnel between some... that connects to some guy's eyes that's, like, tied up, and he just lets loose a little gerbil, like a little guinea pig. And he just lets loose this guinea pig. And it's supposed to be ferocious because this guy, like, sees the guinea pig coming towards him. And presumably the guinea pig's, like, a man-eater or something.
It eats his eyes.
It eats his eyes, and there's, like, blood coming out of, like, this guy's face. And it's like, Jesus.
But at the same time...
I have to ask, if Ali Arkin's listening to this, is this what turkeys like? Is this, like, normal behavior for you guys? Do you like... Because there was a guy that actually called out, like, it's like, oh, we should go tell Ali. I was like, hey, I know a guy named Ali. And I was like, is this, like... Is this a day in the life? Is this like...
Do you have to fight evil Spider-Man and...
Like, yeah, is that how you got your job? Did you have to fight your way to the top in your company?
In a Captain America suit?
Or were you more of a Turkish Santo?
Turkish Santo.
Yeah,
like... Santo is amazing all the time, but Turkish Santo is just... He's a work of art.
Like, there's no police in this area. This is what I'm asking. Like, is this kitchen sink Turkish realism?
There's no police, there's no plot. It's just a series of scenes where Captain America and or Santo beats up goons, occasionally beats up Spider-Man.
Multiple Spider-Men.
Yes,
Spider-Man.
Spider-Man, as it turns out, apparently entered the Konami code before the film started.
Wow, you're such a nerd. Anyway, but yeah, he there are multiple Spider-Men. Like, after a point, like, midway through the film, they realize that, like, once Santo and Turkish Captain America, because we should stress these aren't like official takes on at all.
No, these are total Turkish Santo and Turkish Captain America.
And they're fighting Turkish Spider-Man, but apparently they're fighting multiple Turkish Spider-Man because like it's like Hydra. You fell one Turkish Spider-Man and another will take its place. All hail Turkish Spider-Man. And Turkish Spider-Man or Spider-Man are like popping up like nothing else. And they get away, and poor Turkish Captain America, who apparently the actor who played Turkish Captain America appears to be some kind of gymnast, because like they keep having him do routines on like parallel bars. He's doing like little trapeze acts, like chains. Yeah. He's whipping around, like, or but like it's you know, he obviously has like some kind of athletic acumen versus Turkish Spider-Man, who has like he pulls this Rutger Hauer thing a la Blade Runner, where he like his hands reach through some, like, the wall. Oh, wait, no, that was actually Captain America.
That was Captain America.
Turkish Captain America strangles a man by his hands reach through the wall, strangle him, and then pop through the rest of the wall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's just how Turkish Captain America rolls. Like,
that is, totally.
And at least in that sense, you get what you
paid for. He's like a sadistic Kool-Aid man.
Oh, yeah. Ali, if you're listening, how do you say oh, yeah in Turkish? I have to know. In any case, so oh yeah, Captain America's here. And like you get what you paid for when you see this movie. You get a lot of Santo and Turkish Captain America, Turkish Captain America and Turkish Santo like fighting
and
everyone.
Constant discussion of where the yacht is.
Yes, there's a big mystery in this film. I don't know if anyone can help us solve it, but maybe this is a Turkish thing. But like everyone in this film is talking about a yacht.
I think it's a yacht. I think it's a yacht owned by Turkish Spider-Man and his minions.
Yeah, and it's just like, yacht. We're going to threaten this girl that we just kidnapped by taking her to the yacht. The yacht's around.
The yacht's gone. We lost the yacht.
Yeah.
The yacht's back.
Yeah,
the
yacht's returned. It's like, what's on this yacht?
Return of the son of the creature's yacht.
Yachts. I mean, look at the yacht. I mean,
it's, well, if you've got a yacht and you have these guys' budget, you're going to show off that yacht.
But
that's
they,
all
don't. They don't. That, they don't have that budget, so they don't show off the yacht. And we never fucking know what's the big deal with the yacht.
With the yacht, man.
What's the yacht? Anyway.
Well, so, that's how you know what a pimp Turkish Spider-Man is. He has a yacht. You can't see it, but he has it.
Yeah, there is.
He, it's like the girlfriend he has in another town. You've never met her. She's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, Turkish Spider-Man at least gets down with a girl, whereas Turkish Captain America, I don't know.
And he unclothes for it.
Yeah.
I was so hoping he'd stay in the Spider-Man garb.
Turkish Spider-Man is totally pleasuring this girl. Like, this girl is, like, moaning ecstatically, like, petting his back hair and, like, touching his shoulders. Like, she's having a ball.
And rubbing, like, his voluptuous mullet.
Yeah, his mullet. He's got, like...
Everyone in this film has a fucking mullet.
Turkish Captain America has a mullet. Turkish Santo has a mullet.
Turkish Santo has a luxurious mullet.
All the Turkish heavies have mullets. All the Turkish women have mullets. Probably the crewmen of the yacht have mullets, I'm betting.
And all the dudes have... Well, not all the dudes. The heroes don't, but... Most of the dudes also have these big fuck off porno mustaches.
Oh man, they do. They're amazing. I bet these guys shave one morning. They wake up the next day and it's there. It's just magic. Turkish magic. Pure magic.
It's one of those films that you'll remember fondly, and it's one of those things that's like great for like clip parties and shit.
Oh yeah.
Because you could take any random 10 minutes of this film and people will just stare agog at it, like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, the Spider-Man, all the weird hinky Spider-Man rapist stuff is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, where he stabs that girl in the gut with a switchblade. Turkish Spider-Man has a switchblade!
And I would just also like to point out, Turkish Spider-Man cannot, he has no webbing.
He's got because he's got multiple ones of it.
That maybe he
That's
chose
his weapon.
He chose that superpower instead of the weapon.
Well, it's not like he's got a paunch. First of all, everyone know that Turkish Spider-Man does not work out.
Oh no!
Turkish Captain America works out, and in that sense, you can understand why he's so itching to fight everyone, because he's fit. He's a fit man.
Turkish Spider-Man's too busy being psychotic and breaking into people's homes.
And that's why he's a more interesting character, frankly. Because you don't really care about Turkish Captain America, where Turkish Spider-Man, with his giant Muppet-sized eyebrows, is running around town, threatening women with their own, like, shower curtain implements. I think that was a shower curtain that he impaled those two couple.
Is that what that was?
I guess they were fucking in their tub or something, and he was just like, hey, guys.
And then I think that guy came back later as a zombie. I kind of think he did. But I'm not sure, because a lot of crazy shit happens in this movie.
Yeah, but not enough to keep it interesting.
No, it's one of those things where it's at some point you want it to just settle down. And
simmer down, three dab adam.
Yeah, you watch it like pornography, you know? You watch it for 5 minutes and it's the best thing ever. You watch it for any longer than that, it's like, damn, is this over yet?
Yeah, especially like quality porno, like Super Hornio Brothers, man.
Oh, God.
A little bit of that goes a long way.
Fuck it. I can never get enough Buck Adams. I'm just saying.
I poop from there.
Now you don't.
Oh, God. All right, let's move on to the Netflix
grab bag. So, the moral of the story here is Captain America on cinema. No!
Yeah, poisonous. Poisonous. Her box office poison. And, if you're out there and you're thinking of making already, because I'm sure they're going to reboot Captain America eventually, can somebody please just read a fucking comic book? Don't consult with comic book writers. Just read the comics. Just read some of the Roger Stern. Just read some of the 70s. Read the DeMatteis stuff. Read the Mark Waid stuff. Just get a feel for... Read the fucking Ed Brubaker stuff, because that's pretty good. I don't know why I emphasize that as if that was like the worst thing ever, but like... Just read some of the stuff,
man,
and get an idea of what people have done with the characters. I'm not saying emulate it, but just get an idea of what a superhero is supposed to look like, and what a story for a superhero is supposed to look like, and then just try to make that cinematic. It's not that hard, guys.
Right.
Anyway, so the Netflix wrap back for this month, we had a couple of choices. We had Piranha.
No, Barracuda.
Barracuda, I'm sorry.
An Italian Piranhas, killer fish film.
Yeah, killer fish. We had The Tripper, the David Arquette film, which we wound up going with. We had
Teenage Devil Dolls.
Teenage Devil Dolls. We had Renaissance for this
Renaissance,
one?
The
Renaissance, the Christian Boltman film, which was, for all of 3 minutes, like a revolutionary stop-motion thing. And so, yeah, we went with the Tripper because you voted for it.
And I was all set to curse all of you who voted for it, but actually, I ended up kind of liking it. So.
Yeah, it's mostly, like, I remember having real difficulties when I started watching it the first time, and I gave up on it because the DVD I was watching was fucking up the whole time. But.
Also, it kind of necessarily, I guess, because of what I think Arquette's main goal is, but it kind of necessarily starts really badly. Like, I know you said you liked the opening sequence, but I
like the first half of the film more than the second, certainly.
See, I think it got increasingly good. Like, it started out kind of ugh, and then I started getting into it, and seeing things worth noticing, until about the last 20 minutes, and then it just falls apart and turns into a base slasher movie.
Well, let's tell people what that's about. The Tripper is basically a slasher comedy about a group of hippies that go into the woods for this music festival that's run by Paul Rubens' scrupulous, he's this, like, music organizer.
Uncle Frank,
and he's, like, a total scumbag, and he's, like, taking advantage of everybody, and while this is all going on...
He's Bill Graham. Bill Graham was a complete asshole.
That's actually pretty apt. and he, while this is all going on, some guy dressed up like Ronald Reagan is going around quoting Ronald Reagan and killing hippies with his axe. But he's not only killing hippies,
everyone. That's crucial, because he's not just singling out hippies. Even though Tom Jane says near the end of the film, his deputy asks, "What do you think he's after?" And Tom Jane whispers, "Hippies."
Yes.
But see, that's the thing. It's wrong.
Yes.
He's just a psycho. He's not killing just hippies. He's killing hippies. He's killing rednecks. He's killing cops. He's killing anyone who stands in his way.
And
that's what I think the value of the film is.
We'll
get into that.
But that's the thing. Like, he's just as evil, or shown to be just as, like, soulless as Uncle Frank, who, like, he is, like, a total chiseler. He doesn't care anything about, like, peace, love, and music.
Yeah.
He's just, like, out to make a buck.
Yeah.
And this is why I like the film in the first half more than the second, because in the first half, you have this very gleeful, Robin Hardy-esque sense of humor to it, where it's just very indiscriminately and very pettily, like, anti-everyone. Mm. Everyone's, like, idiotic. The hippies in the film, led by, like, Jason Mewes and Paz de la Huerta, they're all idiots and obnoxious for the most part.
And I completely watched the entire film and didn't realize that was Paz de la Huerta, incidentally.
I recognized her from the start.
Her line deliveries were relatively competent.
And she didn't get naked.
Yes, she did.
She did? I missed that?
Yeah.
Damn it!
Dude, the scene in the van? Remember when Jamie came up with the van? Yeah!
Damn it!
Yeah, she's the crazy cokehead.
Oh, fuck, I need to rewatch this.
Oops.
Privately. Naked. Anyway, the point is...
Simon, I think I have to leave now.
You sit the fuck down! Anyway, so yeah, the first half I kind of enjoy more than the second, because, like, you don't get as cogent a picture of what Arquette's motioning towards, which is basically, like, in the interim period between, like, the Woodstock era of, like, music festivals, peace, love, pot, and understanding, you have, like, this new generation of people that are into this fetishized image of what that time was like, and they're totally into it, but they don't know what the movement was about, and that's why opportunists like Uncle Frank step in, and psychopaths like, whatchamacallit, the Ronnie Reagan killer, are all swooping in there because, like, they're just, like, echoes of what was originally going on. None of what originally survived from that period is, like, history repeating itself, basically, but, like, it's just, like, bits and pieces, like, the nastier bits of history, and I find that to be just, who cares?
I think it's a bit larger than that, though. I think it's significant that the film is called The Tripper.
Yeah.
It's not just a pun on The Gipper. It's, you know, integral to how LSD works in the fabric of the film. Because LSD alters your perspective.
Yeah.
It changes your perspective. But not necessarily in ways that work for you.
Right.
And the entire film, at least from where I'm standing, is about perspective and how everyone views the world and how, down to a man, that view is always wrong. You will never know the entire story. Every assumption...
We don't even know who the Ronnie Reagan character is in the end, do we?
Oh, we do. Basically, it's mentioned in passing. The crazy old guy from the beginning of the film.
Okay.
That is his son.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
The kid who kills the hippie activist with a chainsaw.
Yeah.
Who was released from California Insane Asylum under one of Ronald Reagan's programs.
Yeah.
Which is as close as the film gets to political commentary, but it's not exactly. It's not exactly cutting. We'll put it that way.
The Ronald Reagan character has like dogs that are named after like George W. Bush and things like that.
Bush and Halderman and Meese. And
it's so tiresome.
The political satire of the film is very, very broad.
Yeah,
but
which is why I think Robin Hardy is actually a pretty apt comparison. Although,
but I think that there's a point where it's supposed to be that way, and I think the key scene is the scene near the end where the faux Ronnie goes crazy at the rave and just axing people left and right, and the song playing is Sons of Reagan, punk rock song. I forget who by. But the point is, it's a punk rock song.
Yeah.
And this is a punk rock reaction. It's not supposed to be measured. It's very open and broad and violent and obvious about what it's doing.
But that's the thing. If we're going to talk about punk rock cinema, I prefer... You have to be more energetic than what Arquette brings to the table. Like, all a lot of the slasher material felt really tired. Like, I don't think he understood how... Like, he certainly understood, like, the context of, like... the music festival and the stoner culture that he's, like, dabbling in, but, like, I totally didn't get the feeling that he knew what to do with a lot of the slasher stuff, with the exception of the opening scene where it's like a demented Friday the 13th homage.
See, I had the exact opposite reaction, honestly. Mm. I thought that the opening sequence, which I guess in terms of how I view the film, is kind of important in that you have this super leftist straw man versus this working class guy who actually has, you know, a reason to be at this tree that they're trying to cut down. And, you know, he's working for something. Mm-hmm. So it's again, tying in just how this activist is never going to know the whole story of why this guy's here. But yeah. I just think that is played way broad, and it doesn't really work, in my opinion.
But as the film
rolls on, I think Arquette gets more comfortable with the rhythms of slasher movies. He starts to you know, really get down into how the slasher scenes are framed and how they're paced, and it allows him to play some interesting games with a couple of the kill scenes.
But like it reminded me of Severance. It reminded me of Severance in the way that, like...
Oh, you stop.
It reminded me of Severance in the sense that, like, each... like, not only just in the political commentary, the tenor of it, but also in the way that, like... In Severance, every scene felt like something was on the line. It felt like no matter what you want to say about Severance, you felt something. The violence was much more evocative than it is in The Tripper. The Tripper's just like, meh. It just felt very cobbled together, very lazy. I think that, like, if anything, he was much more energetic and strident in the political commentary. Like, I think one of the things that I really liked... There were, like, two lines that I really liked. There was, like, the one where the message that basically, like, don't trust authority unless you are that authority, where Thomas Jane is, like, told by the, like, is it the mayor of the local town? He says to close down, he closed down the roads to this festival, and the mayor's like, why'd you do that? Open them back up, and Thomas Jane's character plays the sheriff.
He's great in this movie.
I think he's pretty good. It's one of my favorite performances of his.
Yeah, he's obviously having a blast.
Yeah. But I think he's much better than Scott Pilgrim, as with on a vegan. whatchamacallit,
though? Milk and eggs, bitch!
His Thomas Jane's subordinate basically asks him, what? He says, like, are we gonna reopen the roads? And he's like, what? And listen to an elected official? And David Arquette, who is his subordinate, says, aren't you an elected official?
No, David Arquette's not
him? It looks just like him.
David Arquette's one of the rednecks.
The rednecks, yeah. I thought he was both.
He's the redneck who gets killed first. No,
okay. Anyway, a guy who looks like David Arquette tells him, it's like, aren't you an elected official? And he just sort of waves him away. Yeah. That I thought was good. I also like when the final girl in the film, Samantha, who has like a crazy Reaganite ex-boyfriend who winds up getting killed by the Reagan character.
Shouting, "But I'm a Republican!" right before he gets an axe in the chest.
I love where he's...
I suppose if one cared to take the political commentary of this film seriously, one could say how the film's kind of making the case that, you know, the Reagan agenda fucked everyone.
Yeah.
And I think the film ties into that. The film tries to at least get at that with the crazy old guy who has a line. I think the key line for the film is he's talking about laws that help corporations and activists and leave everyone in the middle to get screwed or something to that effect. It's like, you know, because... In that light, I think the straw man that Arquette constructs makes sense, in that you have the crazy, crazy hippies on the left, and then you have the corporations on the right.
And the lawmen are totally the right wing representatives.
Yeah. But they're given more to do than that. I think they become more sympathetic. They're shown to be more than just the representation of the law.
Authority, yeah.
Yeah, they end up being actually fairly complex as complex as something can be in this movie.
As opposed to Samantha's ex-boyfriend who whips out a gun, and they're like, "What are you, a member of the NRA?" He's like, "What can I say? I'm a big fan of Charlton Heston."
But at the same time, he whips out that gun and then doesn't use it.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't use that gun. He can't use the gun. He's fundamentally a pacifist at heart.
He just waves it around.
He just waved it around because.
Yeah.
And Jamie King calls him on it.
Jamie King.
But the thing, I think the film is fundamentally constructed on the idea of constantly subverting your expectations.
You realize this is like the podcast where we flung around the most like macho jargon that doesn't mean anything? Like pussies and wussies, and like, that was mostly just me, so I just like to point out, it was the heat of the moment. I'm sorry. Anyway,
I would quote more of that Asia song at you in response, but I don't actually.
Was the heat?
Yeah, I don't know anything else beyond.
I don't know. Yeah, but, I don't either.
But yeah, I just think I think it's an interesting film that's trying to work with an interesting idea, which makes it all the more disappointing for me when it stops being that stops working with the idea of subverting expectations, and just goes for being a straight up slasher movie.
I think I think one could argue that that's. Built-in construct to slasher films.
And yeah, I understand it's endemic of the genre, and it's not really fair to tar Arquette alone with that, but I also just kind of hate the slasher template. I really do.
Yeah, it's a very dumbed-down version of what Carpenter set up, but that's something for another podcast.
Yeah. In light of that, I do think that Arquette does better than most with the pre-slasher, setting up type stuff. So, yeah. I think that's another reason the film got onto my good side, because I don't find a lot of films, I mean, even a lot of your so-called better 80s slasher films, like, say, The Burning, you're still dealing with half a film there.
Or My Bloody Valentine, the first one.
Yeah, I think My Bloody Valentine is probably the best of the 80s slashers.
Which is depressing, don't you think?
Yeah.
It's not that good.
That's how sad the genre is.
But yeah, I like the meatpacking scene, yeah. But like
I think my Bloody Valentine has it over a lot of others in that it at least attempts to set up an honest look at the milieu it's using.
Yeah,
which makes it to me more interesting than a lot of others. But even with something like that, you're still facing half a broken movie.
Yeah, I agree. I'd say it's about half on target.
Yeah,
but yeah, let's. Let's move on to your options.
We seem to both enjoy The Tripper just for different reasons.
Yeah, it was mostly okay.
Yeah, a lot better than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
I expected it to be pretty fucking dismal. And now I find myself in the weird position of looking forward to Arquette's next film.
He has a next film?
He's apparently shooting it right now. It's called The Club, The Glutton.
What is it?
I assume it's going to be another horror movie.
Huh?
Yeah.
So, for next month's Netflix grab bag, you... gentle listener, can vote for four options that we randomly chose for my Netflix instant queue. If you're not familiar with the Netflix grab bag is, and you were just listening to this and just scratching your head and you're like, "What the heck is this?" Well, then let me explain to you, you impatient fucker. It is a
Tom Anderson from Beavis and Butthead is listening to our podcast.
Yes, exactly. What the heck is this? And sorry, Tom. But yeah, the Netflix grab bag is basically where we alternate each month as to which of our queues, instant or like disc Netflix queue that we choose a random film from. Because, you know, when you have a Netflix queue, you just have such a long list of stuff, and
you throw shit in it, you forget it's there.
Yeah, and it takes so long, or at least for me and Steve, like, you just have stuff there for a while, and you're like, I wonder why I've never watched Strange Circus, or I wonder why I've never watched...
And I would just like to point out right like now that my instant queue is maxed out.
Why?
I can't put any more films into it. It's got 500 films in it.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. Yeah. I've been there. with my regular disc queue, that's happened to me a lot.
Yeah.
But, yeah, exactly. This is what we're trying to combat, people. This is why we have you, the viewer.
Or listener.
Listener, whatever. Who gives a fuck? Help us decide randomly after we chose via, like, just picking a couple numbers from the queue. We have you vote and tell us what movies to watch. So, this month we took from my instant queue 4 titles, which hopefully you'll find interesting enough to vote on!
Yes, please vote!
Yeah, last time it was like pulling teeth with you people.
And, well, to be fair, we had titles from my queue, and there's a lot of shit in my queue. And
it's not bad, I mean...
Because most of my queue leans towards genre cinema, and...
For shame!
It's not. I'm just saying, it's not a lot of shit that people would vote on or even recognize. So,
but yeah. So this time it's from my instant queue. So there's at least a pretense of respectability.
I'm not respectable.
You're not respectable, you bastard. First option is the Pixies documentary, Loud, Quiet, Loud, a movie about the Pixies, which I am very curious about. I imagine that there's a lot of interesting backstory to the band that you could probably read a bunch of very interesting books about, but I'm curious to see what Frank Black and Kim Deal and all the those other guys, those two guys,
the were like. Guys in the band.
Two other, yeah.
The Pixies were one of those bands that, I mean, I grew up kind of right in the heart of the alternative explosion, mm-hmm. And they were one of those bands I knew about, and I knew a couple songs from it, and I never somehow got into.
And I think this is about the road to their reunion tour, which I actually saw them perform at Jones Beach for, which was actually pretty awesome, because they were performing with LCD Sound System and Interpol. Damn good show. No one was there for LCD Sound System at that time, because, like, unfortunately, like, even though they were a pretty known quantity by that time, this was before Sound of Silver and before they mounted their comeback.
Their big single was Losing My Edge, or was this post Daft Punk playing at my house?
This is post that, definitely. This was like, yeah, but this was basically back when it was just James Murphy and like a couple of backup guys rather than like an actual pretend to be band. So he was there and it was awesome, and the Pixies just rocked. They rocked it. But yeah, so there's that. There's Bamoko, the...
It's an African film.
Yes. Thank you. Director Abdurrahman Sissoko. It's an insightful social drama that juxtaposes the troubled relationship between a bar singer and her unemployed husband with the overwhelming economic hardships of Africa.
This isn't the film about genital mutilation, is it?
No.
Okay.
No, that's another one. I think you're thinking of Mulade.
Thank you.
But that's a Cizay film, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You're right.
But yeah, this actually, I believe, is a courtroom drama.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. I remember it got exceptional reviews when it came out.
Yes.
And it played at Film Forum. So I'm very curious how that is.
I think it was also a New York Film Fest pick, wasn't it?
It was. You're correct. But yeah, the next title is Todd Haynes' first film, Poison, a love story, I believe, is the surtitle. Which I've never seen. I like what I've seen of Haynes' stuff of late, and I'm dying to see Mildred Pierce.
I've heard it's very good.
I've heard Mildred Pierce is amazing, and I'm very much looking forward to it, considering I loved I'm Not There. And, I'm more than willing to believe that his latest HBO thing is a knockout.
Poison's been doing a revival.
Yes, it has. Haynes has been doing it, too. He's been... working like a slave for this, an Egyptian slave. Just so we're not thinking that I'm racist about this podcast.
You're already catching flack for using macho adjectives.
And gook.
I think you meant to say goon.
Goon, yeah, I meant goon. Anyway, the last option is The Verdict, the Sidney Lumet film, Paul Newman, where he plays a drunk lawyer mounting his comeback case and trying to prove to everyone that he's not just the guy that's been lost in a bottle for X number of years. And
the point is, it's Sidney Lumet, Paul Newman, Oscar nominations out of Yang Yang.
Yeah, can't believe we haven't seen it.
Should have seen it already. But.
Yeah. Especially since the Lincoln Center has the Lumet retrospective going on right now.
Do they?
Or at least they did.
Okay.
Which I was kind of curious about, just to see a bunch of his stuff, like The Hill, The Offense, and The Wiz on the big screen, but
oh yeah,
that.
The Wiz, baby.
I'm curious. I haven't seen it.
But
do you want to see that on the big screen? Anyway.
Close to the four.
I think we'll close this podcast with a quote from 3 Dev Adem. Latest news, rich woman killed in her bathroom.
Bum, bum, bum.
Think on that. In any case, we are your hosts once again, Simon Abrams.
And Steve Carlson.
And we will see you next month.
And we're going to get drunk now.
Bye-bye.